Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and may be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Looking forward to the show tonight.
Well, I think we're going to have an interesting one. It sort of came together at the, not the last minute, actually. We were pretty well, pretty proactive today. We started really seriously planning for the show, what, about 8 hours ago, 9 hours ago, something like that, I think.
Yeah, we all, it's funny. Sometimes we have a deal where we plan shows weeks in advance. You know, we might have like a series of three or four shows or even more. And then there's other times where, you know, we're just doing individual topics. And sometimes the individual topic shows, we can get down kind of to the wire, and they still manage to come together somehow. So that's good.
I think it has to do with the talent. It's the talent on the show. It's all sitting right there. We got to meet those guys, by the way, whoever the talent are.
Yeah. Whoever we're borrowing it from.
On loan from someone, maybe from Rush Limbaugh. We know where he gets it. So, anyway, I just noticed that Sally in the chat room says congrats for having our review posted on Kurzweil's website. Thank you very much for that, Sally. And actually, there's more news on the Kurzweil front. Stephen, if you want to go ahead and plop that into the – or actually, I can. What am I saying? I'm in the chat room.
Yeah, you can do it.
Check out this link, Sally. Oh, yeah.
What makes that so cool is, I mean, here's a list of podcasts that Ray Kurzweil's website, you know, recommends, and guess who's at the very top of that list?
Let's see. Like CNET or the Discovery Channel or somebody like that, I'm thinking, right?
Actually, they're on the list below us. Yes, we are at the top. So, yay us, you know.
We're at the top of the list of podcasts recommended by KurzweilAI.net. Now, it's entirely possible that the new one goes on top. But you know what? We're still at the top of the list. That's
that's right.
However it happened, you know, however that came to be, we'll take it. We like being at the top of the list. And I want to actually give a shout-out to our friends over at Kurzweil, to Mara Angelica and to Sarah Black for helping us get that up there and get our review up there. And really just say a word of appreciation for the folks who work at KurzweilAI.net. What a great site that is. We've been recommending them even before they put our podcast on, I think is fair to say. But anyone who listens to this program, who reads The Speculist, and who isn't taking that newsletter every day, you're really doing yourself a disservice. It's a tremendous resource, not just because they're publishing our stuff, but because a lot of the ideas that we get, a lot of the news that we get on what's happening around these topics actually comes from there.
Absolutely. I've been following that list, I guess, that newsletter, I would guess probably 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, that's how, almost since I started doing it. So it's reading it daily, it's good news. It's, you know, anytime that you get a little bit down by reading the economic news, it just seems to get worse and worse. Do yourself a favor and go read KurzweilAI.net. It's pretty awesome.
It's a great site, absolutely. And subscribing to the newsletter or getting on the blog feed, either one, is just a great idea. for keeping yourself informed. It's kind of like subscribing to Stephen's Twitter page, really. Actually, you get a lot of the same news, won't you?
To some extent, yeah. Because part of the tweets I end up retweeting come from that Twitter feed. So, yeah, but it's lots of other stuff, too. Yeah.
Well, of course, but, you know, if you subscribe to Stephen's, then you get that value add, right? You get the Stephen's spin on the whole thing. So. That is key right there. So recommend both. I'm not saying one or the other. I'm saying do yourself a favor and, you know, get going with both, people. That's my advice. So now speaking of advice that I've been freely giving on how people can become more tightly linked to bringing about these transformations of the world, getting hooked into the acceleration agenda, I want to give an update on the plan that I announced last week for us to propagate the book, The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley. We've taken on this ridiculous goal of trying to get the book Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley into the hands of 1,000 readers who otherwise would not have read the book. And I'm very pleased to announce we really got the project started yesterday. And as of this evening, do you know how many we've got out so far, Stephen?
Five or six? What is it?
We're up to 7 already. We're up to 7.
All right.
As I mentioned in my blog post this morning, I did 4 myself and have heard from 2 readers so far, one who's distributed 2 copies and one who bought a copy for himself. By the way, that totally counts if you weren't going to buy it until you heard about it from us. I think we take credit for those 2, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
Okay.
And, go out and get you a copy and give a copy away. I'll probably buy 6 and give them away at Christmas time. If I don't manage to get them all away before then.
Well,
so.
We'll be into our 4th or 5th 1,000 by then. So, you know, but that's fine. that'll be important too. That's an important contribution too by Christmas. We were sitting here trying to figure out at the rate we're going how long it will take, but it's a little premature to be making any predictions around that right now. So even though we like predicting the future, I want a week or maybe even 2 or 3 weeks worth of data points before we can start projecting
our sample size. Yeah, our sample size is a little small yet.
It's not statistically significant at this point. But we'll see. Anyway, I was really, really pleased to hear from a couple of readers, and I hope that those of you listening will take up the challenge. And if you do take up the challenge, please let us know. Now, right now, the only channel we have for letting us know is my email, unfortunately, just because we're still in a transitional place with the Speculist. I've been working on a movable type upgrade since, it feels like since the late 70s, but actually it's since July I've been working on this thing. And there really is light at the end of the tunnel. I was thinking I'd get through it this past week, and I'm pretty sure I'll be through it next weekend, at which point we're going to start taking blog comments again, and the comments are going to be better than they've been in years. I swear it's going to be really sweet. I don't want to oversell it, but we've had a fairly clunky comment interface for at least a couple of years now, and I think folks are going to be very pleased with the commenting interface that we're going to have, but we don't have it yet. So, and I haven't set up the Facebook page because I want to do this in phases. I want to try something each week, something different each week as far as promoting this idea. So the Facebook page will be coming out this week. I believe that was Sally's idea. Thanks for that tip, Sally. In the meantime, if you give a book away or buy a book, send me an email. It's just my last name, which is available everywhere throughout the Speculist, @gmail.com. So Bowermaster@gmail.com. Drop me a line. Let me know. We're doing it on the honor system. So, you know, don't write and say you gave 10 away. I mean, just, you know, tell us the truth. And we're going to try to get to 1,000.
That's great. Well, you know, our comments, we want to move past the problem of either it being open to any spam bot that cares to fill up our comments on the one extreme or on the other extreme, making it nearly impossible for humans to leave comments. So, Got to find that happy sweet spot in the middle, and looks like.
Yeah, I mean the thing is, we had it open for everyone, and it was just too time consuming for us. We had to go in, and it was just this chore every day clearing out all this ridiculous spam, and looking for the good comments. And occasionally, I'd get so overzealous in clearing out spam that I'd throw away a couple of good comments. and I hate that. I mean, that's the worst thing. So yeah, it was like, you know, too hot, too cold. We're looking for the just right, and this later version of movable type that we're moving to provides what ought to be the just right solution. It's one where, yes, you have to register, but you can register with any of a number of different accounts, your Google account, your Yahoo account, your Facebook account, in any number of different ways in, so that you don't have to create this separate identity, although we can make that possible too, so you can have just a login at the Speculist. But the point is, we don't want it to be cumbersome. We want it to be very easy to get a conversation going, because we've had great discussions in the comments in the past, and kind of missed that. Look forward to getting that back very soon.
Absolutely.
Well, also, the page will be wider, and so HD YouTube videos will fit.
I'm looking forward to that.
the kind of hanging off the edge of the page, which kind of has its own sort of charm, I suppose. But it looks like we didn't think things through, and I want to at least give the appearance that we've thought things through. So I'm sorry, Stephen, where were you off to?
Well, I was just going to jump right into the show, the topic for tonight. So basically, we're talking about the American dream, aren't we, Phil?
We are. We're going to talk about the American dream, and we're going to use that name, American dream, since we have a global audience here, to talk about what that means for us and what that same kind of idea means maybe in other cultures and other contexts. That's actually a great place to start is, how do you define the American dream, I wonder?
Well, part of it is that I would say that a big part of the American dream has always been that we're optimistic about the future. And historically, Americans have been optimistic about the future. Things are always going to get better, no matter how great things are now by comparison to 10 years ago. We see a decade out as being even better. That historically has been a big part of what the American dream is about. And so, we see the lives of our children being, even sweeter than our lives, which are, greater than the lives that our parents had and their parents. So I guess that's probably the biggest part of it as far as the American dream.
I think you're right. I think, in fact, if I could shorten it to three words, the American dream has always been a better life.
Yeah.
That people would come from other places to be here, or people would aspire to start a business or to get somewhere in their job or to go to school. But it's always been this idea of I'm going to make a better life for myself, for my family, and yes, my children will have it better than I had it. I'm working to have things better than my parents did. I mean, not in a competitive kind of a way, but just because that's what they wanted, right?
Right.
Kind of a way. It's striving for a better life. Very much in line with so much of what we talk about here. The American dream is a very speculist kind of idea, I guess, when you put it in those terms. So, I think that.
I think it's fair to say that the American dream has had a global impact because, around the world, I would say things have been getting better for a long time. And I think some of the reasons that America has been so optimistic historically are now a global phenomenon. And so obviously that's not a bad thing either, is it?
Not at all.
There's not one good stuff pie that if America gets too big of a piece, there's not enough pie left for the rest of the world. It doesn't work like that.
Right. That's right.
There's not a finite amount of wealth to be made. You can go out and bake new pies.
Maybe there is a finite amount of wealth, but man, we are nowhere close to it. Okay, I mean, it's just ridiculous how far we are from even touching it or even worrying about that. People like I don't know, I can't think of his name, economist.
Malthus or whatever.
Oh well, yeah, actually, yeah, he worried about it, but he worried about it in way too limited of a terms. I'm actually thinking of doggone it, the guy who. less, not less wrong, that's Eliezer Yudkowsky, the, I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, so, yeah, and I think it's important to point out that there was an American dream before there was an America. You know, I mean, that this has been an ongoing pattern, but we kind of put our stamp on it, right? We said this whole idea of improving your circumstances is a big part of what we're about. You know,
right.
People, you can come here and then nobody will tell you what to do anymore. You can have your own land. You can have your own home. You can have your own ideas. You can make your own destiny. That's the American dream. You get to decide what your life is, and you get to make it better.
Yeah, we don't care what, quote, class of person you are. You know, you could have been the dregs of society in the country you came from, but if you come here and you pursue your dreams, you know, we're not going to say that, you know, you're not an aristocracy, therefore you can't participate.
Exactly. Robin Hanson, that's who I was trying to think of. And, I mean, he projects into the very distant future when the entire universe is filled with intelligent beings and we're, like, actually running out of hydrogen atoms, right? Okay, that's, you know, that's the real limits, okay? That's the true Malthusian vision. And even that has, you know, workarounds. You talk to some of these other folks, and they've got some pretty good ideas for how you work around that. Okay, so that's good. That's, you know, I think all in favor, show of hands. We all like the American dream. So you sent me something about this today, Stephen. What's the latest on the American dream?
Okay, so this might have been a little bit of an uncomfortable question for our president. President Obama was asked by an Indiana law graduate, is the American dream dead for me, or perhaps for my generation? I think that's a question that's kind of been on the minds of quite a few people. Is, you know, are the best days of America, and maybe you could say it a little more broadly, best days of Western civilization behind it? I mean, you know, are we experiencing the sunset years now, or is this just a pause while we get ready for something even greater? I think that's a pretty fair restatement of the question.
So what did the president say?
Well, he basically was kind of a little bit of a non-answer, basically saying, well, you know, we're working on, we're moving in the right direction. We're pursuing these policies of stimulating the economy and this and that. And it didn't really answer the more broad question, though. He basically was saying, here's things that we're doing to make things better, but did not really address the question of, you know, are we at the end of something here, or is what's happening? So.
Interesting. So I see in at Instapundit where this link came from. One of Glenn's readers wrote in. This is very interesting what he wrote. He said, "I think the notion of the American dream needs to be recalibrated, especially the whole question of whether your kids will be better off than you. The standard of living floor has risen so much over the past 60 years or so that it's difficult to quantify an increase or to set realistic expectations. It's kind of like my grandmother who passed away at 93. As I got older, I told her I was jealous of the advancements she witnessed, from seeing her first car while riding in a horse-drawn cart to indoor plumbing to the moon landings, and that I didn't think anyone outside of her generation will ever see such a radical change." Well, okay, wrong, but anyway. "My father immigrated from the Middle East, and his arrival to the U.S. may as well have been to another planet. Given that past and the fact that the," and he puts quotes, "poor in this country have microwave ovens, cable TV, and cell phones, and technological advances seem focused on laptops and phones, what does an increased standard of living look like anymore, and how does that translate to thoughtful and achievable, quote, American dream? This will be a critical concept as we try to pull ourselves out of this financial mess." Now, when I read that, I was immediately reminded of Cory Doctorow's novel Makers and the people living in the shanty town. This idea that, you know, are they poor? Are they okay off? Are they well off? There's almost, you look at those characters in that book and it's like, well, we really don't even have categories for people in that situation in that book. And what this fellow's name is David Shirash seems to be suggesting is that maybe our categories of economic advancement, our categories of economic success are not going to be as relevant in the future, that we'll have to measure this by other means because standard of living is likely to continue to increase.
Well, here's,
I think, well, that actually sounds like a pretty good thing. You know, I'm like, well, that's not bad. So what is the real fear? I think the real fear is whether that standard of living increase maps to, and tell me if I'm overthinking this, an actual quality of life in, improvement. That's ultimately what we're looking for. Or is that somehow being erased from the equation? Or is it going someplace else completely? I don't know. I appreciate your thoughts on that, Stephen.
Well, in the book, The Rational Optimist, he made a big deal about an illustration involving the amount of work necessary to produce reading light, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, basically he was saying, I believe, if I remember correctly, like in 1800, you'd have to have an hour of reading light, you needed to work all day, and, you know, and it'd probably be low-quality light, too, you know, just a candle or two. And then, you know, now you know, working 30 seconds gives you, like, a couple of weeks of reading light, basically.
Right.
I think a way we can perhaps measure wealth and an improvement of our condition that maybe is not being measured really at this time is computation. How much work do I have to put in to buy cycles of computation? How much does it cost me to buy computation? That's growing by leaps and bounds, isn't it?
Absolutely.
About every 18 months, the power of a computer at a given price doubles, I believe. And so, you know, let's say, what I could buy today is for $1,000 is double what I could buy, you know, last year for $1,000. That should be factored in to how things are coming for the American dream, basically, but and the worldwide dream. But I don't think that's really factored in very much.
I think that's a forgotten
part of it.
And it's one of the drivers, if not the driver, of why we're able to grow the economy so quickly. That is the leading edge of automation. And it's automation and the incredible leverage that you get from it that has made the economic growth that we've enjoyed. The economic growth, actually, the technological and economic growth that Instapundit reader described in talking about his grandmother's life, you know, was made possible by this wave of technological development and this wave of economic development. And when you talk about what's happening with computing power, that's the front end of that wave. That really took over as kind of the driver of our economy. I'm not even sure when it happened, 25 years ago, and it's hard to say how far it will or can go or where it takes us next. And I think it might be the uncertainty about that is unsettling for folks. We've got HB in the chat room saying the American dream works because people believe they will have a brighter future. Lately, they aren't feeling that way, and I think that's really at the heart of the question that the young man talking to the president was saying. I don't feel that my positive future is as guaranteed as it might. Might be or might have been, right? I mean, that's kind of the my paraphrase of what he's asking. You know, is the American dream going to work out for me? There's not as much certainty about that in people's minds as there was. Now, this is where I want to bring in a dose of Kurzweil. Okay, this is where I would remind folks what Ray Kurzweil talks about in the book. The singularity is near when he outlines the law of accelerating returns. And there's a funny thing about the law of accelerating returns. It seems to work just about equally well no matter what's going on externally. I mean, certainly there are occasional fits and starts, and there are things that that you say, wow, well, that's really thrown us off course. But if you look at the period of time that that man described, that independent reader described his grandmother's life going through, that century, we're essentially talking about the 20th century, included unbelievable economic and technological growth, as well as what? First World War, Second World War, the Cold War, right? I mean, unbelievable upheavals, unprecedented upheavals in the massacres and genocides, and I mean these horrible, horrible things occurred, and yet we came out of that century astoundingly ahead of where we where we began that century. So I think that when people ask those kinds of questions, when they have those kinds of doubts, it's very natural to, it's very understandable to, and I'm not suggesting that we can just put blind faith in technology to take care of us, because we have to assume that that the future truly is open-ended. But I think you never want to lose sight of how resilient that kind of progress seems to have been in the past, and how resilient I think it still can be, and probably, I think most likely, still is even today.
Right. I would say one of the things that makes it so resilient is globalization of trade. In Matt Ridley's book, The Rational Optimist, he says that without trade, innovation just can't happen. Exchange is to technology as sex is to evolution.
Right.
It stimulates novelty. So, I mean, if for example, some person in India has this idea of how to make something just slightly better, then that idea doesn't just stay necessarily in their local area. If it's a good enough idea, then it'll be adopted elsewhere, and ideas can travel around the world that way. Because everybody's always looking for some way to make some process or a product slightly better than than the competition makes it. And so ideas don't just stay in one place. They get adopted. They get brought into the worldwide stream of ideas, and it creates innovation, which makes things better and better. And often the product that you get is much better for the same money as just a few years before. Thinking perhaps of for example an automobile. How many miles? What's the most number of miles you put on an automobile in your life, Bill?
I'm probably not a great person to ask that because I had one little Toyota. I guess I put about probably put about 120,000 miles on it.
Okay. No, you're probably not the best person to ask about it because you probably trade in your cars a little more often than I do. Right now, I'm driving a vehicle that's got 140,000 miles on it. The best feature of this vehicle is that it is paid for,
mm-hmm.
And I suspect that before the wheels fall off of it, and I just have to get a different vehicle, I'll probably put 200,000 miles on it at least. Maybe I might squeeze in 225, and I've done that before with other.
So you can say you drove it to the moon, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When just visiting with my father about it, he says, that's remarkable because, when I was a kid, if my parents could get 50,000 miles on a vehicle, they were just ecstatic.
Sure.
I know in a lot of ways vehicles are more expensive because so many things are required of them now, safety glass and other safety features, for example, engines you're able to put so many more miles on them. They're just so much more reliable as vehicles than they were before, and that's partly because of global trade.
Yeah, well, it's like cars are evolving at this accelerated pace. If you look at cars as though they were living things, think of this vast evolutionary process they've been through from being these extremely simple internal combustion, hand-cranked things, 100 years or a little more or so ago to these really sophisticated electronic fuel-injected self-parallel parking with video rear view systems, and I mean it's really amazing to think to think of how far they've come. But what has driven that, and what has driven just the durability and the quality of them, which is ultimately what you're getting at there, is exactly the process you described, and it applies to everything that gets produced. The knowledge of how to do something well persists. So once we figure out how to make an improvement, that stays, either because it's been written down or you've got an example of it in the product that you've produced, so that the next time you want to make an improvement, you're not just back to where you were before, but you're improving the improved product. And the terrific thing is we have this dynamic, diverse, growing population of consumers who kind of drive this, right? Everyone has their own specific sets of wants, needs, perspectives, preferences, and all of those help to shape what shows up in different material goods, what shows up in ideas, what shows up in information and programming. And it's like we all help to create this by being kind of picky, by being kind of, well, I don't like it that way, the way I'd really like to see it. Actually, this sort of dissatisfaction that we always think we should just get past and be content with our lot in life really helps drive the whole thing. Because if I'm a little dissatisfied with it, then I'm going to tell the person selling me something, well, I might go over here. I think he might have something better. And that continues this process of ideas improving and improving and improving on top of improvements. So you get these incredible just evolutions of technology, best exemplified almost certainly by electronics technology, by information technologies we've seen over the last few years. By the way, we're always talking about the movie Wall Street. Have you seen there's the sequel coming out to Wall Street?
Yeah, it comes out this weekend, doesn't it?
Does it? Okay, so I only noticed that they show the Michael Douglas character getting out of prison. And they're handing him his personal effects, and he's voiceovering. He's talking about, maybe I was in prison too long, and they hand him that phone that you and I have talked about. That relic, that museum relic of a phone. And what was that movie, 1985, 25 years ago?
Yeah.
And that thing is a joke. You look at that and you go, you've got to be kidding. I mean, if you get your hands on one of those, just hold that up and hold an iPhone next to it or a BlackBerry or anything next to it and say, wow, there you go. Yeah, 100 years of cars versus 25 years of phones. It's really pretty astounding.
Come a long way. And you remember back in the 80s when American car companies were really, really struggling versus Japanese car companies. There was this, basically a big push here in the United States, Bill, where, you saw all these bumper stickers and things, buy American, buy American.
Yep. Yep.
I think basically the argument was this, be true to, be patriotic and be true to the country, even if it means buying an inferior product. No one ever came out and said it that way.
Right.
But basically that's what it came down to.
But even if it's not as good, go with your own, your homeboy.
Even if it's not a Toyota Camry, you need to buy American and support American workers and things like that. That campaign was of limited use. Okay, it did not, sure it was, it probably convinced a few people, but by and large, when it comes time to buy the second most expensive product in your life, and the first being a home, okay, the second most expensive product in your life is going to be your car. Okay,
right.
your vehicle. When it comes time to buy that, you're gonna try to buy the best quality for the money you have, and so people continue to buy what they thought were the best vehicles, regardless of where they came from. Now, of course, vehicles are so worldwide. You could buy a Ford and it'd be less American than a Honda. You know, it's so it hardly makes any difference.
Sure, you can buy Subarus assembled in Indiana, right? I mean, yeah, absolutely.
That's right. And you know, and Fords that are assembled in, you know, I don't know where, Korea maybe, but
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
We're relieved of any duty of any feeling of needing to buy something that's considered American, in part because there is no such thing as a strictly American vehicle anymore. You just buy the best,
I think it's very interesting that you bring that up, because that campaign, that idea, you should buy an American car, that loyalty, that kind of insisted upon loyalty to the American automakers, is probably why two of the big three went bankrupt. You know,
right.
One of the big three went bankrupt twice. We've gotten to bail that one out twice. But there's a lot of other factors, and I don't want to get into all those. That would be, you know, wide of our discussion. But somehow the notion that something other than producing the best quality car, the best possible car, entered into the equation. And if you're competing against someone who does produce the best quality car, and you're saying, well, I'm going to produce a pretty good quality car, but I also got all these other things to think about, you lose, right?
Yeah.
You can't win. I mean, there's no way. So I think that's why two of them ended up going bankrupt. And it's to Ford's credit that they got on the quality bandwagon and started producing good vehicles. And this is not to disparage the products produced by Chrysler or GM today. I think all three of them make outstanding cars today. But there was a time when they were less outstanding than they are now, and that was right when they needed to be making that shift. And instead, people were arguing buy American. I think that hurt them quite a bit.
Yeah,
that's
just absolutely the wrong emphasis. Buy the best, and you know, why don't we make the best right here? You know, that might have been a better way of looking at it.
Exactly. So here's a related question that was raised in another Instapundit post. This is another kind of Instapundit night here on Fast Forward Radio. We have these from time to time, right? Glenn, he blogs a lot. He gives us a lot of stuff to work with. But this one, after you showed me the link about the American Dream, this one kind of seemed to be echoing it and taking the entire same discussion and looking at it from just a slightly different standpoint. But here's the post. He says, a future of liberty or dependency? We will soon reach a point at which most of the people have their standard of living subsidized by the earnings of a quarter or maybe a fifth or fewer of the rest. No nation can sustain the economic and cultural strength that has graced the United States while transferring so much wealth from so few to so many. Now, I'm pretty sure that...
Here's,
go ahead.
I agree. That's a rather libertarian or conservative viewpoint, and that's kind of the way I lean anyway. But then we hear arguments like those made by Martin Ford, that make you think that, well, you know, that's the direction we're going anyway. Because here, basically, let me describe it real quick, and you correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, Phil. Okay. His argument is this. Here we are. We're innovating all the time. Technology is going forward all the time. And so if you are a company that's interested in making something cheaply and doing a good job at it, then you're going to begin to adopt more and more automation. Let's say you're McDonald's, and you're looking at ways to offer your quarter pounder cheaper than the Whopper down the street. What do you do? Well, you know, you might want to start putting in machines that will basically do all these different things. You know, you have an automated fry cook. You have an automated hamburger flipper. And pretty soon the whole place is running just one robot handing it off to another, basically, with maybe one human manager watching the whole system. And you don't even have somebody taking orders up front. It's more like an ATM machine where you place your order at. And we've even seen systems similar to that being tested in Germany. I had a YouTube video a while back I put up on the Speculus showing that.
That's
so
right.
What happens when all the jobs at McDonald's are automated away, all the jobs at, you know, all the fast food restaurants, let's say, and then other jobs begin to be automated away to the point that, you know, normal people are having a harder and harder time finding jobs. Now, keep in mind, America at large and the world at large could be as rich as ever. You know, you can make just as many hamburgers with robots as you ever could before. But, you know, how do people then afford all these goods and services if there's no jobs around to allow them to have money to purchase these goods? And so, anyway, that was. Am I getting it pretty close?
That is the conundrum. That is absolutely the problem that that Martin Ford outlined for us.
And basically, Martin Ford's answer to it is, well, welfare state. You know, you what you end up doing is you'll end up taxing the McDonald's that fired all their workers, and then turning around and sending welfare checks to the former workers, so that they can then go buy, you know, their quarter pounders with cheese or Whoppers, whatever they feel like buying. So, you know, I think that was basically his answer. And man, that just doesn't hit me right. I mean,
it makes me queasy. The saving grace for Martin Ford, I think, is that he didn't like the answer that much either.
Exactly. He didn't like the answer either, but he's saying I really don't see a way around it if we automate our way, you know, to the point that there are not too many jobs left for normal people anymore.
Yeah, he was offering that as an alternative to collapse and chaos, and I must say.
Right.
That in those terms, yes, I'll take it. Absolutely. You know, that is a good alternative to collapse and chaos, I think. But it's not an idea that sits particularly well. You look at it and you go, well, there must be another way. But I'll tell you, every what about this kind of thing? I thought if he had an answer for it, I'm not sure I completely agreed with every answer, but you know what I mean? There was thought behind it. There were real objections, not just this was a guy who really wanted there to be a welfare state, so he thought up a rationale for putting one in place. That was just about the opposite of how you get there from Martin Ford. One of the reasons I think we would ever have had somebody arguing for the welfare state on Fast Forward Radio, because we're not really a show about that kind of stuff, but that's how we ended up there. Here's the interesting thing to me about that idea. This blogger who provides this quote, we're going to soon reach a point where most people have their standard of living subsidized by the earnings of a quarter, maybe a fifth or fewer of the rest. Now, what he's talking about is not necessarily something that's automation driven. He's talking about the fact that we've already got government imposition on the economy, and we've already got a situation where the government steps in and tries to flatten things out and provide things for people and you know, make things fair, right? Make things better for people at the bottom and more fair for everybody. And so when he argues that no nation can sustain the economic and cultural strength that has graced the United States while transferring so much wealth from so few to so many, I see his point. But I disagree with his terminology. I'm not sure it's really an argument about transferring so much wealth from so few to so many. I think it's really about imposing that model on an economy that would probably respond much better, much more fruitfully, that would grow a lot better without that model there. Because ultimately, if Martin Ford is right, one of the scenarios we have to entertain for how the future might go, one of the worlds we might end up living in, is one where indeed, most of the people have their standard of living subsidized by a very small minority of people who work, or just by the machines who work. I mean, it's not my happy go-to scenario for the world. I think, you know, actually, I could get by okay having a machine send me a check every week. I'd figure out something to do, but my point is that is a plausible end state for the world. So I don't think the question should be – I don't think the blanket statement should be that you can't sustain your economic and cultural strength. The question is, how do you sustain your economic and cultural strength? What do you become if you put this in place, if you haven't thought about the impact that this has on people, if you haven't thought about what this does to people culturally, economically, socially, to suddenly not be people who earn but people who are paid, because all the earning is done by either a very small class of workers or no workers at all, and all of it automated. I don't know the answer to those questions, but I know that those are the questions that have to be asked. And one of the things that some of the political debates that we get in this country worry me about is that we draw the lines around, well, we could never work that way. Well, it's like, well, what if things were really, really different and it had to work a different way? You know, we have to imagine things being substantially different from the way they are right now, not because they will be a particular way, but because they almost certainly will be extremely different from how they are right now. That's the part that we have a hard time getting our head around. And it seems in particular with economic theory, people are very much wedded to ideas of economics that grew out of 18th, 19th, and 20th century, the great industrial revolution that swept the planet, and really that defined economy in a way that had never been defined before. I mean, really, you know, how much economic theory went on in the world before the Industrial Revolution? Maybe a little. But I think the field really kind of came into its own in the 18th and 19th century, and 20th century especially, because there was so much more economics going on. There was so much more of it being practiced to generate interest in it. And I think the problem we run into is we think we've got this all figured out, and we're probably just at a phase where we're really ready to start learning how it works. And that's why go ahead.
I was just thinking, another great example of that is healthcare.
There you go.
All these debates over nationalized healthcare here in the United States, I mean, that so much of that was based on, medicine will always be the way it is right here, right now. And actually, probably some of it is medicine will always be the way it was, 20 years ago. They weren't even taking into account really the state of the art. Even they, some of the ideas that reflected were just old, worn out ideas. And I mean, even things like how physician assistants and nurse practitioners are beginning to already to revolutionize, healthcare. Let alone the idea that perhaps we'll have expert systems and AI systems, basically in some ways practicing simple medicine going forward in the future. And to the point that we might even have onboard doctors, actually within our bodies, treating us in real time. I mean, those sort of technologies could be around the corner, just in a few years, and that'll revolutionize medicine. And here we are talking about building this mammoth system based on some really old ideas of how medicine will be practiced. And I suspect a lot of people are in for some surprises.
Well, I think, we might end up with completely subsidized, government-sponsored, even who knows, even privately sponsored free health care for everyone that might work on a model like the public library works on, okay? I mean, and I just throw that one out there. That's just, that's just one possible model that doesn't sound like it has anything to do with health care, but only because we haven't taken into account how commoditized things can become. Things will become commoditized if you allow them to progress to that point. There was a time when an optical disc, a CD, was a very expensive, very valuable thing. And that's been, 25, 30 years ago when one of those would have seriously set you back some, or probably more like 40, 50 years ago when one of those would have really set you back some money. And then they started putting music on them. And then there was this time when AOL was really making a big push, I'm going to say mid-90s, late 90s. It's like you'd get an AOL CD in your mail, like, what, three times a month, right? I mean, they just would show up. They were, I think, it's just like Netflix doesn't have a overdue policy, right? They don't care if they ever get those things back. They're a commodity. They cost about the same amount as the envelope that the Netflix disc comes in. And yet at one time those were extremely, extremely valuable, extremely expensive. We had the same kind of discussion when we talked about the World of Abundance, when we had this great story of a multi-million dollar laser printer versus 30 years later the free laser printer that the guy didn't even want to bother to take, right? It was like, well,
it'd be too much trouble carrying it through the mall.
Yeah.
You know, the
what happens when a machine that is intelligent enough to diagnose and actually treat most illnesses is as readily available as AOL discs were 15 years ago, okay? Or, you know, as printers are. I mean, you know, you get them as a free premium for doing something else. As far-fetched as that sounds to some people, I think that is a very realistic possibility, and I think that if you look at the future of how healthcare is provided and a future where healthcare can be available to all people, that's the one, you know? I mean, that's the one that really gets you there. Trying to make more of something by distributing it differently doesn't work. I mean, mathematically it doesn't work. The 20th century, it seems like we had that century to prove that that's an ineffective way of trying to achieve economic equality. Or as we were talking about last week, yeah, it achieves economic equality by making everybody equally poor, right? So, you know, it's like we can achieve healthcare equity by having everybody have crappy healthcare instead of just some people having crappy healthcare. The real impetus should be on how do you
use
the track?
Go ahead, Phil.
I was just going to say, how do we take this principle that you've been talking about, this principle of, that turned Gecko's phone into an iPhone, right? That turned the Model A into one of these self-parking BMWs. You know, how do we take that principle and allow that to provide us healthcare? Because it seems like that's a lot more powerful and a lot more effective than any bureaucracy could ever be at getting healthcare out to everyone.
Well, and one way of doing it is just leave it alone. You know, when you have a bottom-up system that's building better and better cell phones to the point that we moved from Gordon Gecko's, you know, brick to this, you know, remarkable machine I have in my pocket. You know, I mean, what do we, you know, what government program provided that for us?
Right.
None of them did. But you know, you start. What happens when basically you got a top down system that's basically dictating what's going to be provided is you tend to calcify in one area. You know, I mean, you end up with computers on space shuttles that are like 30-year-old computers and wondering, my kid, you know, astronauts flying space shuttles are wondering, you know, why are we using these old machines here, when my kid has a better machine at home,
right?
You know, and part of the reason is just legacy. You know, we've done things a certain way, and the bureaucracy has basically mandated this is the way we do this, and so you end up with systems that have basically calcified because, you know, that's the way some top-down system has said that it ought to be. And so I see that as sort of an enemy of innovation.
I think you're right. Well, in fact, great piece that Reason put up over on Fight Aging, Attitudes and Regulations That Hold Back Progress, is the title of this article. And he writes, "The advance of medical science would proceed far faster if not for certain attitudes pervasive in the research community and the heavy shroud of regulation that drapes every human endeavor in our modern societies. I've written on these topics in the past and the cost of central control of medical research in particular. Under a regime in which all that is not permitted is forbidden, we should not be surprised to see that barely a fraction of the potential of each new discovery is utilized." And then he goes on and gives depressing examples of how this turns out to be the case. So here's the very process we're talking about being stifled by top-down control. If the very process of generating good new stuff is slowed and dangerously slowed by top-down control, how could the distribution of it ever be benefited by putting that kind of control in place? To me, this is simple math. This is simple logic. It's not ideology at all, and it's not a lack of interest in seeing health care provided to everyone, because that's truly what I want to see happen. We read that passage from Matt Ridley's book last week, and I'm so on board with, yes, I want to get health care to everyone. I don't see this doing it, okay? I don't see this plan increasing the amount available, right, which would be the first thing you'd have to do if you're going to get health care to everyone. If you want to get health care to everyone and not everyone's getting it, it seems like there needs to be more than there currently is. And when you put a large bureaucracy on top, you're almost certain to create, if nothing else, greater inefficiencies, which will reduce the amount of care that gets received. If nothing else happens, it's going to cut the amount of care available that way. But I think all the other factors that you described come into play, and you get the opposite of what it is that you're trying to accomplish. I think the reason to be opposed to a top-down approach to a very bureaucratic nationalized healthcare system is because you care about people's healthcare. That's the reason to be opposed to it. If you want everyone to have good healthcare, that's the reason to be opposed to that. As far as I can figure it out.
Let me just give an example of, for example, at the FDA. Now, what could be more important and a more noble mission than to make sure that drugs are safe and effective? You see people that are on the verge of death being denied the opportunity to try experimental drugs, because the FDA thinks that, the drugs might not be 100% safe and effective. Well, good grief, if the person's got a month to live, why don't you allow them to, to risk, I've got a month to live. I'm going to risk it. I'm going to risk those 30 days. In exchange for an opportunity to maybe beat this cancer or whatever,
It just goes to show you. I mean, there's a certain mission creep because you have to have an FDA. I mean, you do. You do have to regulate controlled substances. You do have to regulate medicines. I don't think anyone would argue. Maybe people would argue that point, but I'm certainly never going to argue that point. But yeah, it seems like that's the problem with top-down approaches is they always thwart themselves. The good that they're trying to accomplish, they stand in the way of. And that is a perfect example. If you've got people who are terminal and these experimental treatments might help them, the worst these experimental treatments can do is kill them, and they're going to die anyway.
And their death would have meant something. It might tell the doctors, well, maybe that's not the right drug to use.
Right.
Next time we'll try something slightly different, that might – turn that 1 month into 2 months or something. You would think that there'd be a little bit of leeway built into the system for those who are terminal who are trying to fight aging.
You would think. Well, listen, we climbed down a healthcare hole that we have to climb out of because we're out of time. But I just want to close on this note, okay? The American dream is not dead. If anything, it's in a cocoon. I don't even think it's in a cocoon. I think the glorious transformation is occurring now, the metamorphosis, and we're going to see an unbelievably rich and diverse economy in coming years. And I believe everyone who needs it is going to have health care. I think we're going to end up in that world sooner rather than later. I just think that how we get there is probably not through a government mandate. I think how we get there, how we enforce it in the end might be a government mandate, but how we get there is going to be a lot like how we got to the iPhone. Okay, what's our music for this evening?
Waking Up in Texas by Janine Wilson.
Janine Wilson sings Waking Up in Texas. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks for your contributions to the program, to Sally and all our friends in the chat room. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. Everyone listening and listening live, we'll be back again next week. Until then, hey, pick up a copy of The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley, and let me know about it. Until then, live to see it.
change.